This is Air Commander Starscream, and you are listening to Half Measures. Half Measures? Sounds like Megatron's battle strategy.
Kia ora and welcome into episode 168 of Half Measures. Joining me on the microphones is a person who will be remembered for the rules he's broken. A microphone is just a microphone until Dan Whiting King talks into it. Kia ora, Dan.
They do say, Paul, the rule, you'll be remembered for the rules you break.
Correct.
You know, no one remembers the late nights. No one remembers the extra effort you put in. It's
the rules you've broken. That could be a special podcast we could do. The rules that Dan Whiting King has broken in his career. That would be a great podcast. I'd listen to that.
I think I'm saving it for my memoirs. You know, I've been working on the. I don't really have the memoirs, but I've got all these chapters of what I could talk about, and I think this would be Broken Rules would be another great one.
If you ever have the pleasure of bumping into Dan on the street at some time, just one of the questions I recommend you ask him is, can you tell me some of the chapter names of your memoirs? Because this book is writing itself, and every time you've got a new chapter title, it really excites me.
Do you know, it's funny, I haven't added any chapters for a while. In fact, I should have a look at it. Maybe it could be an exclusive one day. We'll go through the chapters.
I don't think we can mention them on the podcast, unfortunately, but they're worth asking Dan about. Please do get in touch if you'd like to know more.
Maybe it'll be a Patreon perk, you know, like once we get so many, like you can get like a signed copy of the book once it eventually gets written. I'll probably need to be on my deathbed though, because I feel like some of it could be like a little bit controversial.
Oh, you can't burn bridges. This town's too small. This country's too small.
Yeah, indeed. Maybe that's the title.
Yeah.
Burning Bridges. All right.
Dan, do you want to kick us off this week with what you have been watching?
I can indeed. So this week, I've got a couple of things for you. So I'm going back to a classic to start off with. So this is the old palate cleanser, the what do you watch when you're eating dinner, when you've just got 20 minutes to spare. And we have decided to go back and watch Parks and Recreation. So this is like, you know, it's up there with The Office for me. The Office, I think, trumps it. But I've been wanting to do a rewatch of Parks and Rec for a long, long time. And I've been waiting, like, it used to be on all the platforms, but now it's only on TVNZ on demand. So I'm having to watch it with ads, which is not ideal. But when you're only sort of 20 minutes, it's not too bad. So I've just watched season one. In the early stages of season two, 7 seasons of this TV show. It's good, Paul. It's good. It's so much obviously it's, you know, creators of The Office behind it. It's got like a stellar cast, like, you know, people like Chris Pratt before they became, you know, Chris Pratt, Aziz Ansari. It's the humor, the jokes are on point. It's still as relevant today as ever. The first season, so focused on filling in the pit behind Ann Perkins' house.
That's right. Oh, Ann Perkins. That's right. Oh, so good, Dan. So good. And Ron is Nick Offerman as Ron is just one of the all-time greats.
It's so good. Like just the, you know, on his desk, he's got his Claymore mine, like facing the person who would sit down in front of him. He's got the shotgun facing him. He's got all that sort of like military stuff. I love how anti-government he is. I love how he's like anti-progress. I love how just like Leslie is such a, like she's such a nerd for sort of politics and just the parks department. And I know that a lot of these characters kind of evolve as the seasons go on, but season one has been so good. And the great thing is Samara's seen bits of season one, but she hasn't really seen all of Parks and Rec. So she's having a great time. She's laughing out loud. It's so good having a 20-minute watch back in my life.
Amazing. I think to your comment earlier about comparisons with The Office, I think in terms of longevity, I think overall, I think it's one of those ones that the later seasons are of a higher quality, whereas I think maybe a season or two at the end of The Office wasn't as high. And I just think as an entire package, and of course it's a lot less episodes. What is it, 7 seasons?
Seven.
It's that's a great a great palate cleanser. We're now coming through to the final third of Seinfeld and always talking about what's the next one going to be. And it feels like you always want to go back to a classic because it needs to be good.
Well, and that's the thing, you know, like I say it all the time, I can do an Office rewatch any day of the week. But I feel like this is just something a little bit different. Like the jokes aren't as fresh. I don't know it as well as The Office, but there's a lot of good stuff that happens, a lot of great long-term jokes. It's just a good, even thinking about it right now, I want to go and watch an episode. It's a good one. I think it would be better to watch it without ads, but you know, beggars can't be choosers. The fact that it's available on TVNZ on demand, still awesome and not too painful.
And of course, as you say, Chris Pratt, before he became Chris Pratt, you know, now, of course, with the Marvel Universe, with the Jurassic Worlds, with the Lego, you know, so many things that he's done, but there's something about this, how do I say it nicely? Because he's, you know, he's really sort of cut guy now and all the rest of it, but like him back in the day, a kind of an out of shape Chris Pratt, just loose, is just really, really enjoyable.
It's so good, isn't it? Because, and you know, his character was only meant to be in it for the first season and then they were going to get rid of him, but he's just such a star. In the season two, sort of early on, he brings out his FBI character, Burt Macklin, and it's just like, oh, I love this. Like, I love it. And then they just kind of embrace the Burt Macklin persona all the way through. And the fact that even just characters like April Ludgate, played by Aubrey Plaza. Oh, yeah.
She's good too.
You've got characters like Donna or Jerry, and in the first season it's a bit like the first season of The Office, where a lot of those guys were kind of just extras and didn't really have any talking roles. I just love that they go on to sort of be key characters in the show.
Jerry, it's so amazing. I can relate to Jerry in The Office many, many times over, but I think, yeah, just it's, when I look at the photos, it's the Ron that's really making me, yeah, I want to get in amongst this again. I'm gonna put this in the mix for consideration of next palate cleanser for us.
Put it on the table. It's so easy, and it's a bit like Seinfeld, right? Because 20 minutes goes by so fast, like 10 minutes to eat your meal, a few minutes just to kind of like, you know, settle in and get comfortable. It's just perfect.
Nice.
The other show that I have watched, Paul, is one that you brought to the pod a couple of episodes ago. I have watched The Night Agent.
Ah, what is the verdict?
Mr. Kind Eyes himself.
Yes.
I've got to tell you, Paul, this one wasn't for me.
Oh, no, it's a miss.
It's a miss.
I've oversold it.
Well, interestingly, it's a split decision in our house, and I know when Samara listens to this episode, she's going to be like, oh, you're so hard on it. It's, you know, but it's like, I think we kind of went into it with different things. I think, where do I start?
You went looking for kind eyes and you found none.
Well, so I think there's an interesting story in here, but I think a couple of things happened. I think from my perspective, they played it a little bit too safe with the story, and it felt very much like I was watching, you know, back in the day, New Zealand's only got 3 TV channels, in fact, 2 for the longest time. It felt like this is on, you know, Monday nights on TV2, the Night Agent's on. It kind of had that kind of vibe to me. And I think the thing with this show is I wish either A, it was a movie, or B, it was only about 6 episodes long. I felt like I just want to really crunch it down. And the reason I want to crunch it down is I feel like the first episode kicks off with a roar. it's interesting, kind of the premise of being a night agent. Obviously, that the conspiracy starts to sort of like play out within government. But I kind of found like over 10 episodes, like so many different sort of character arcs. I didn't really necessarily felt like I was that invested or cared about some of the other characters, and yet we still had their story. I felt like it overstayed its welcome just a little bit too much, and I kind of wanted more core Night Agent, and it wasn't there for me.
I remember when I brought it to the pod, I remember talking about some of the criticisms around it being too, some cliches or a bit too nice in places, and I know what you're saying in terms of it's not perhaps quite as edgy or raw or whatever, you know, it does. I know what you mean. There are times when perhaps it does play it safe at times. And I think there were just things that I was willing to forgive because I was so invested in the two leads. I thought that the chemistry of Peter and Rose together, I thought was superb. I really liked what they were trying to do. I loved the character of Diane, who's, I said, when she swears, she really swears, and she's really good. I don't know. I've agreed with a Patreon producer in your household probably far more often than yourself. So I'm not sure.
Yeah, and look, I did actually appreciate with like Rose's character in particular how sometimes like when things would be like obvious or a bit of like a gimme, I enjoyed that her character would sometimes call out those things and she'd be like, oh, wouldn't we just do this? Or, they not going to have guns? Or like it was, I think it kind of would. I do think I'm probably a little bit of an exception to the rule, and I don't know what it is, Paul. Like I know that there's something wrong with me, but as soon as I watch a show like this, as soon as my brain starts to be like, I can't, like it's like a snowball, and it just keeps, and then all of a sudden I start disengaging, I start criticizing everything about it, I don't feel invested in it, and then it's, like I start to hate watch it, and I'm like, oh, don't hate watch it, but it's like I can't turn it around.
Remind me never to go for an interview where you're on the panel, because if I do, just give me the nod when your brain starts going, yeah. So the title of your autobiography is now switched to I Know There's Something Wrong With Me. Okay, that's a good title too. I like
that. It's good. So look, I'm being overly critical of it. I know that this is a show that probably appeals to a lot of people. I'm kind of intrigued where they might go with a second season. Like it could still be interesting. Like I feel like it for me that like if this was what's it scoring on IMDb? Like I think it's scoring relatively well to 7.5.
Seven and a half.
Yeah, like it probably feels about a six for me. So it's
strong finish though, right?
Yeah, like I think a relatively good finish. And I think a few of the characters are where it's real strengths. Like I liked Peter Sutherland, I liked Rose Larkin, I enjoyed the Diane Farr as the chief of staff. Like there was some good characters, but there was also a lot of other characters and a lot of other sort of story arcs and trying to make it more complicated than it needed to be.
That's a fair call. That's a fair call because when I strip away some of those actors and start looking, I enjoyed Debbie Woodside as Eric Monks as well. But I know what you mean there. Maybe there was a bit of fat that could be trimmed away. Just on the subject of IMDb, Dan, if you scroll down a bit further, they finally brought in something which I've been looking for ages, and that is they now give a summary by episode across the bottom, and you can just see the scores. So that you don't have to click on episodes and then click back. You can sit on one screen. It's a really nice feature. So you can sort of see how it trends ratings-wise across the whole thing. And so I'm really glad you watched it. I feel like, look, when season two comes out, we'll do a joint review. I'll hold your hand as we go through it and you'll be fine.
God, I've got to come back. Okay, all right. Now we'll look, I just have to acknowledge, I know this is a show for certain people, and I know that this really works for people. I think it's because this genre, I feel like I like it. Like, I like the foot on the pedal all the time. And
yes, you do.
So, anyway, let's move on, Paul. What have you been watching?
Well, Dan, what have I been watching? I dare say that I've been watching a show that, once again, the Patreon producer in your household may well be watching and you won't be watching, and that is Queen Charlotte, A Bridgerton Story on Netflix. Am I right?
You are 100% right. This is in the Bridgerton universe, I understand.
The Bridgerton universe, indeed it is, yes.
Is it about family or not about family?
It's all about family, and that's why I thought you actually might be keen to give it a go. But so Bridgerton, as I've talked about before, it's set in the early 19th century in London, and the main series is about rivalry between these two families. But this series is something of a spin-off in that it follows the character of the Queen, who we see in both those first two seasons, but it focuses primarily on her youth and how she came to be Queen. And it does jump back to the timeline in which we know the Queen from season one and two, but mainly it's her younger days. So whilst there are a few familiar faces, when we jump forward, 80 to 90% of this series is new characters or younger versions of a few characters we do know. So the world does feel familiar. You're quite correct. It is the Bridgerton universe. And of course, we know that she's going to become queen. It's just the whole point of the series is how does that happen and the journey we go on. So it's new, it's different, but it's very, very Bridgerton. And I had a great time watching it. It was really good.
This is where, again, there's something wrong with me, Paul, because I know that, you know, one of our Patreon producers, or a couple of them, are a big fan of this genre. I just look at all of this, and it's like nails on a chalkboard to me, and it's like I don't know what it is. Like, I just can't, like, and I'm like, is this a musical? Is this, like, what is it? And I feel like it can't be a musical, because Paul would hate a musical.
Correct. You know it's not a musical. No, it's period drama at its very best for me. And I think I've said something similar to this before, but I'll say it again. It's what I love about Bridgerton is it takes the best of, like, British period dramas and just gives it a really sophisticated edge, a bit of a sideways glance with a more, you know, a more modern racial and gender attitudes. But it just, yeah, it takes all the best parts of, like, Downton Abbey or like the 95 Pride and Prejudice, those sorts of things, and just ramped it up a few notches. And there's a lot in this that I really, really did enjoy. A number of times throughout the series, it plays out the same scenes but from slightly different angles, which is something they haven't done before, and I really enjoy TV shows that do that, as long as it serves a purpose. So you get to see from different characters' perspectives and with a different lead into that story, so you get more context about a scene you're seeing for the second time compared to the first time you saw it. And what I enjoyed about that is it does a really good job of making you think or rethink some of the judgments you made when you saw the, well, at least as far as I did, because I made some judgments. So, for example, there are scenes where King George's behavior, his choices, his coldness, it makes him very dislikable. And then in a subsequent episode, you see the scene from his perspective, and you learn to understand why he's made those painful, deliberate choices. And it does have a very, very, very touching finale, which is quite beautiful, to be honest. And I would wager not a dry eye in the house.
Wow. And so, you know, so coming into a show like Queen Charlotte, is it critical that you've watched Bridgerton beforehand, or is it just a bonus that you're in the universe?
I would say you could get away with not having watched it, but there are, so one of my criticisms is that with Bridgerton, there's lots of different stories going on with lots of different characters, but here what we're doing is we're focused in on just a couple of characters, and that's fine. But what it does mean is that there's less story to flesh out. So, you know, we're sort of exploring these characters. But when we go off into some of the sub-stories, they're referencing things that have happened in the first two seasons because we're back in the future. And so that would make no sense. I'm not sure if it would really matter, because it's a journey of Charlotte becoming queen. So you could probably get away with it. That being said, I would say season one of Bridgerton is still my favorite. Then I would say this Queen Charlotte spinoff, and then I'd go season two, because season two was a bit too sort of, oh, will they, won't they, just way too often, too much. It was a bit frustrating at times, actually, but there's a lot in here.
I love that you love this, Paul. It's it warms my heart.
It warms your heart. I do have to mention, in terms of cast shout outs, I just thought that, I'm not sure how to pronounce it, but Corey Malcriest as King George, the young King George, I thought he was quite exceptional. And one of the reasons for that is, of course, is that one of the things I really enjoyed about it is King George. I don't know much about him beyond the fact that we all know that he went mad. And I watched the movie, the 90s movie, The Madness of King George, with Nigel Hawthorne. In fact, I actually went to the cinema and saw that movie. And so seeing another angle of how that madness manifests itself and whatever was very fascinating to watch, and a very difficult acting challenge, I would have thought, for this Corey Marquis. I thought he was really, really good. And India Matafilo as the young Queen Charlotte, she is very, very, very strong. Both leads, superb in that respect. So yeah, so I did enjoy it. I did really love the finale. I do hope, and we're going to get a third season of Bridgerton. There's a lot in here, and the music is another thing. And I've talked about this before, where they've got modern music songs, but they're still played in an orchestral way, you know, whatever that word is, you know, in a classic sound that you'd expect for this period. And you could easily miss it if you're not paying close attention. But when you listen to the melody, there's modern artists like Alicia Keys, there's Beyonce, there's Whitney Houston, and it's just very subtly done. And it really works very, very well. Because when I say it out loud, it sounds like it could be quite cringeworthy, but it works really well.
No, I think that is probably the one draw card for me into this universe is the music does appeal. And I do appreciate the way they've kind of, like, as you say, they've like modernized a whole bunch of themes. And that does make it kind of interesting. This has spawned another question for me, Paul, unrelated to this TV show.
Mm-hmm.
In the British education system.
Oh, wow. Here we go.
like, are you at school? Hello, Paul. Hello, Governor. Like, you're at school. Like, yeah. how far back? Like, do you kind of study the royal family in history, or is it just sort of how deep is the average English child in the monarchy?
Well, I don't know. I mean, back in the 80s, that is all I can tell. I mean, most of the time I was, you know, as you know, with me skiving off smoking in the bike sheds. But when I was in class, we had to get up on the hour every hour and sing God Save the Queen. That was mandatory as well. But no, the history was far broader and far further back. My memory of what we learned in history was mainly about the Romans and the Vikings and Saxons.
Okay, interesting.
There's another one. There's a fourth one. I've forgotten who they were. That's how good I was at history, obviously. But there's very little about modern day history. We didn't even study much about the wars. It was all medieval. I wonder if that's why a lot of those TV shows now don't actually interest me as much, because it just used to trigger me at school that was all we used to learn about. But so nothing from this period of time was ever. And so I wonder if that's something I've just come to appreciate, or I have to be honest, it's as I've got older that I've started to really sink my teeth into a lot of these shows, which my wife has been a fan of for far longer than me. And I've sort of gone on that journey and have started to really, you know, like, I was the one that said, oh, should we watch Queen Charlotte? And she was like, yeah, you know, it's like, we're right in tune, which is great.
Nice. Oh, that's very good.
So, yeah, so that is available on Netflix. Definite recommendation from me. The other thing I want to talk to you about, Dan, is a movie I watched. And here we go. So this is a movie about a woman called Blanche who moves to New Orleans to live with her sister. But whilst she struggles to deal with her brother-in-law, as she gets there, her whole reality crumbles around her. And this is a classic Hollywood movie. And this is A Streetcar Named Desire from 1951. So I will be talking full spoilers, given this has been out for 72 years. You've had fair chance to watch it. So this is a classic, a famous Marlon Brando, Vivian Leigh movie that I've always wanted to watch. Firstly, the name Streetcar Named Desire has always fascinated. Like, what is that on about? It makes no sense to me at all. I can reveal that now. Basically, there's a scene very early in the movie where Vivian Leigh's character, Blanche, tells the stranger that she's supposed to be getting on a streetcar that's named Desire, and she's looking for it. But this is basically one of the you know, this is the streetcars that go through that's going to Desire Street. And so it is a streetcar which has Desire on the front of it, and that's all it is. And you see that for streetcar for 5 seconds, and that's it. And so that's that mystery solved.
Look, the closest memory for me of this is, I'm sure there's a Simpsons episode where Ned Flanders plays Stanley and Marge plays Stella. Stella! Is that it? Okay.
And I'll come to the Stella scene, because it's I was ready and waiting for it, because, you know, I don't think it was the Simpsons that I was referencing, but it really checks out that that's what was in your head. What a great poster. This is a movie that I think it was around the time I realized that we hadn't done a peak performance for Marlon Brando. And I started thinking about which of his classic movies, like, you know, On the Waterfront, Last Tango in Paris, which ones could I go watch I hadn't seen. And I went looking around and I found this one on Neon. And I have to say, Marlon Brando, this is only his third movie at this point as well. He has an on-screen presence that hits home. Like, I know this is very old now, this movie, but it's just so present. It's just so good. He's so slick. He's so stylish. And the closest I think I can sort of compare it to, and he even sounds a little like him, is he reminds me of a younger Leonardo DiCaprio in terms of just how natural he is on screen. And he's so standout, with the exception, I would say, of Vivian Leigh as Blanche. The rest of the cast, you can tell that everyone else is acting, but Brando is just the part. He's just natural. He's in a real league of his own. So that, from a point of view of watching this movie, that was worth it for that alone. And I had a look on our website, Dan, in our movie section, which you can sort by year, which is a really useful function. And I discovered this is the eighth movie that I've brought to the podcast and reviewed that's been from the 1950s, 60s or earlier, excluding any of the Bond movies, that is. And this one ranks the lowest of the pack for me. And I'm really surprised. And I'm also really disappointed, because I was thinking, oh yeah, I'm watching A Streetcar Named Desire and I'm going to bring it to the pod and sound all cool and sophisticated. And really, I'm just coming in saying, I didn't enjoy it. It didn't hold my attention. The dialogue was just too much for me. I felt like I was watching a Broadway play. It was too overacted and I just didn't buy into any of the support cast. And it's really disappointing. And this movie rates pretty damn good, you know, 7.9 over 100,000 votes. It just didn't grab me and I feel gutted.
It's a shame. It's I feel like I've learned a lot tonight, Paul. Like, if you'd said to me, if you gave me a pop quiz about what is A Streetcar Named Desire about, I would have been like, look, it's about a race car. It's about, like, you know, like, I would have gone down a whole different path. And yeah. So I'm intrigued, and I appreciate your commitment to taking it old school.
Oh, look, I really enjoy old movies. In fact, I would say, give or take, my dad and a couple of friends of ours in Ireland and one person I can think of at my work, I would say I'm a bigger fan of older movies than anyone else I know. And I feel like I watch them more often too. And so, yeah, many of them do resonate with me. And I'm starting to get a feeling that a lot of the time it's old sci-fi that resonates really with me a lot. And this one just didn't. And in the end, I was just waiting for it to finish, which is an awful feeling. This movie's only 2 hours. And yeah, the dialogue was too much. The big famous moment that you're referencing, you know, where he's screaming Stella in the street up to her bedroom window, was in the end actually underwhelming. And, right. You know, when I think about scenes in Casablanca, which I have watched and I love, that is a classic, and those scenes are strong. This one just didn't get me going. And there's also something else I want to touch on that's disturbing about how Brando's character Stanley is able to manhandle Stella in a very, you know, awful way, in a drunken rage. But then the film romanticizes the fact that through it all, she's able to accept how he's behaving, and the music rises to a crescendo, and the story dismisses what's happened because it's okay, because she's wowed by the fact that he's kissed her, and so all must be right with the world. And I don't know, I guess what I'm saying is there are some definite moments in this movie that perhaps age it and date it more than the fact it's in black and white with less sophisticated camera work. It's actually some of those moments that really you just wouldn't, that wouldn't be a narrative that would be told in modern day times. And obviously 1950s, it certainly was.
Well, I guess that's the thing. We're, what, 70 years old? Like, this is a, you know? Yeah.
So, yeah.
Interesting. Well, that's always what's hard about sort of, you know, particularly older movies, right? Like, it's just, it's the madman effect. Like, it's just different time, different place. Like, and none of that stuff would have even been looked twice at, you know?
No, that's right. That's right. But as I say, in actual fact, there is a tense finish to this movie, which is good. And there's something about the finish that actually feels real and relatable to the world, as opposed to the stage play that sort of played out. So that's good. Vivian Leigh is good. Actually, Kim Hunter is good as well. I'm bringing a bit harsh as Stella. Kim Hunter is also good. And of course, Brando is just exceptional. But I wouldn't recommend this unless someone wanted to watch it in the background whilst they're doing something else, maybe. But if you're in New Zealand, it's there to watch on Neon.
Did you know, Paul, that in this movie, the film set, the apartment, the Kowalski apartment, actually gets smaller to heighten the suggestion of
claustrophobia?
Yeah.
That is cleverly done. So just as I was saying, that the cinematography and things weren't there were some moments that you can spot which are done well. Things that Hitchcock did well with the movie Vertigo to give that impression, there's similar moments to that, some very clever work. So yeah, so maybe I'm being a bit harsh on that, but yeah, I did notice that. Well read then.
Look, I can find the quick fact with the best of them.
So that's that. We've got a couple of joint watches this week, Dan. Shall we move into our first one, our TV series Beef?
Let's do that. So, yeah, I actually came to the podcast last week with Beef, and then Paul informed me he only had two episodes to go, so we've saved it up for a bit of a joint review of this one. So the premise here, this is a Netflix TV show. Two people let a road rage incident burrow deep into their minds and slowly consume their every thought and action. So this stars our much-loved Steven Yeun from The Walking Dead, and Ali Wong. This is a 10-part TV series. I'm intrigued to hear what you thought of this one, Paul.
So I nearly missed that on this altogether, and this, there's a lesson to be learned here for sure. So I'd seen this come up, and I wasn't sure. And then, you know, my wife asked me, she was like, oh, do you want to watch this? And then I thought, okay, let me have another look at it. And I looked at the synopsis.
Hold on, I'm watching Bridgerton, you know.
Yeah, that's right. I'm still watching On the Waterfront, and I've got another 6 black and white movies. Give me a chance. And I saw the synopsis. Two people let a road rage incident bury into their minds and consume their every thought and action. And I thought, is this going to be, you know, and I saw that it's comedy, and I thought, is this going to be a bit too slapstick? Like the poster, even now I look at the poster and I'm like, it means something different to me now because I've watched the show, but at the time I'm like, I don't know, maybe this is going to be a bit too much, and it's going to be back and forth trying to get each other back. And would it be for me? So in the end, I just said, no, you go ahead. And I thought, no, I'm not going to. And so she started watching this herself, and within the first 5 minutes, she pressed stop, and she insisted that I sit down, and she went back to the start and watched the first 5 minutes again. And what a great decision that was, because within the first 5 minutes, I knew instantly the flavor, the feel, the energy, the rage, the hatred were all the things that are part and parcel of my day job, actually. I was like, oh, I love this. I need to get on board. And so, to cut a long story short, I watched the whole thing and absolutely loved it. What about you?
Yeah, no, look, I had a really good time, and it's, when it first came out, like I was watching, I think we were watching Succession at the time, so it kind of took a bit of a backseat. And I heard people reference it as a, you know, is this a bit of a White Lotus? Is this, you know, this is, and I think I came into it with quite high expectations. And I think I kind of went on, it's a TV show where I went on a bit of a journey. So I thought the first, you know, half an hour was sort of great with this road rage incident and how it all kind of plays out. I then kind of felt like some of the things that they were sort of doing to get back at each other, like Amy and Danny's sort of characters, were good. Some of it kind of was, I want it it seemed to sort of like peter out a little bit and sort of focus on other characters. But what I really found in this TV show is I kind of came to love the other characters in this just as much as our main cast. And I think by the end of this TV show, it really like turns up the tension to such a high level. Like that sort of those final two episodes, or particularly their final episode, are such a different vibe, and things have really gone off the deep end compared to sort of where we start. So I think this is a really fun watch. I really enjoyed kind of, I think, understanding the Korean and Japanese sort of cultural aspects of, you know, I guess what family means in America through your culture and sort of through that lens, and just seeing the way that people are kind of living. And obviously like Ali Wong's character, Amy, was, you know, she just lives this complete life of luxury, whereas, you know, the complete opposite for Steven's character. And it's, look, I had a lot of fun. This was a good watch. A real easy watch as well. Like it seemed to go relatively fast. So I would recommend this one.
Yeah, a definite recommendation. It definitely does. You're right. It does go fast because we've got 10 episodes here, but it did not take long to go through the whole thing. And I think what I found incredible about that is it's one of those series that keeps getting better till the end. For me, I felt it really just, as you said, it sort of ramps up and ramps up. And I think the writer, Lee Sun-jin, needs a real special mention here because he did a superb job in as much that he takes a comedy drama to the next level. This is a difficult combination, as we've talked about in the past, of genres that have failed to work on many occasions when they put them together. But here they get the balance right, and the recipe is just absolutely spot on, because yes, it is a comedy, but there is a lot of serious moments in this movie. There's some dark moments and some very, fair play to Steven Yeun, because he's so authentic. When, you know, when those, he's great in the comedy, but in the serious moments, like when he's crying, he's amazing. He's a million miles away from that young Glenn we encountered back in 2010 when he started out there, you know. And I just thought that we saw him briefly in Nope, and that was great to see him. But this is the real treat of seeing him now. Anna Wong, probably though, the standout for me. I just found her journey and her rage and her energy and the way she responds to people is my inner voice at work sometimes.
Even her husband, and I even just love like Stephen's like younger brother, yes, Paul Cho. Like it's like just such a great cast of Asian actors. And like one of my favorites is I just love the sort of like the band of friends, the cousin that gets out of jail,
yes,
just the antics that come up with it. And I think under all of this, like as you say, like it is a comedy, but it's dealing with some really dark themes, like without going too much into sort of like deep spoilers, like Danny Cho is like, he's deeply depressed. Like his life is not going in a great direction. And you can see how, you know, somebody cutting you off in a car park is just kind of, it's the Michael Douglas falling down moment that kind of like triggers a series of disturbing events. And, you know, in this day and age, it could happen to anyone.
The Michael Douglas falling down, or the Russell Crowe Unhinged, where it's just that one thing too far. You know, I mean, I don't want to worry anyone, but there are moments where I'm like, how close am I to actually losing it? How close am I? Like, I had a moment, I'm just going to go off track briefly. I'm not going to mention the company, but I was in a store the other day, and I was getting such bad treatment at the counter that I was just so enraged. I was tempted, as I walked back down the aisle, as I walked past, just to stick my hand out and just knock all the things off the shelf as I went. I was visualizing it in my head, and it's that sort of rage that that you feel here. And there's something about road rage that is a different tier of rage. I don't know what it's like when we're behind the wheel, something else happens, and when you see it on TV, you relate to it, but It's dangerous, and it's dangerous because the single moment in time that provokes, you know, an emotional response can lead to the most incredible consequences. And what we learn in this, of course, is that it's not just you who's affected, because what happens here, it affects multiple people's lives.
Mm, definitely. I think also I loved, what's her name? Maria Bello is like such that, like the out of touch, millionaire, who's wanting to invest in Ali Wong's business and sort of take it over. Just again, like her character arc, again, even though sort of like briefly included, is it just ends with such a bang.
Yeah, that's a good shout. Actually, I don't think I've actually seen her since A History of Violence. Is like it feels like the last time I sort of saw her, but she was really good. Actually, I would have to give a shout out while we're talking about different people in this. I would. Because I haven't seen her for a while, is Patty Yasutake, who plays Fumi, George's mum, so Amy's mother-in-law. She is she played Nurse Ogawa in Star Trek: The Next Generation for like a decade, and I've never seen her in anything else either. And she was hilarious. There's just a lot of standout roles, but the writing, as I always talk about, was just there in terms of that brilliant comedy, brilliant tension. My only criticism of this series, Dan, for me, in light of your criticisms, is actually that the ending, even though it ramped right up, the actual ending scene, the final scene, without being specific, was too much. It was too surreal for me. And they almost went too far the other way in terms of forgiveness, if you like. But that's a minor complaint for me, to be honest, in a very, very satisfying watch.
Well, I actually think, and I haven't done any research into this, but classic Half Measures, is like you could almost see like a season two of Beef with a completely different cast, but just kind of like the idea of kind of, you know, like incidents that kind of happen that kind of trigger people. And a little bit like The White Lotus, which is, you know, sort of set in these different White Lotus holiday accommodation spots, that the Beef could be the same concept, because I just can't imagine, like, I feel like Steve Nguyen, like, he's so, like, I feel like he's so hot right now that he can't, like, he could do whatever he wants. And I feel like, are you getting him back for season two? Like, I don't feel like he's a season two type of actor anymore.
No.
Like, he's a kind of a one and done, and I'm moving on to my next project. So it would be intriguing. I would say my criticism would be, and I feel like it's just such a common catchphrase for me, I think they probably could have made this 8 or 9 episodes. Nah, okay. Not a movie, but maybe 8 or 9. Like I don't think you have, like, is it a rule that you have to have 10, like 6 or 10 episodes on Netflix? Like, is there some witchcraft? Like, you know?
When's the last time you watched a show which was 7 episodes? It's like,
I know, right?
Sometimes one more will be enough, but 3 more or 4 more is too much. It's like, just needed one more. But no, that's a fair shout, because there was a period perhaps in the middle where, as you say, they went into other characters, but it kept me hooked. I was invested in characters. It was believable situations. I thought it was just really raw. The story flipping all the time, like it felt like one person had the upper hand to another, and it was outrageous in terms of the lengths they'd go to, but not in an over the top way that I feared. When I said, you know, oh yeah, I don't think I'll watch this, I was worried it would be that slapstick, and it wasn't that. Instead, it was just really entertaining that whenever they did something, I was like, oh, I cannot wait to see the other person's face now that this person, you know, now that one of them's done that. Mm-hmm. So yeah, a lot in there for me. And you know, once again, another hit for me on Netflix. This is a year of Netflix that I haven't seen for a good 3 or 4 years.
Yeah, look, I've definitely added it to my list for potential top 10. I don't think it will make it to top 10, but I think it could very much be a sort of runner-up, so or a mention. So, but you never know, like with the writer's strike and various things going on, who knows? It could just as easily make it. But this is a, I think, a good, fun watch, as you say, on Netflix, relatively easy. You'll have a bit of fun. You'll have a few laughs. But it's relatively serious as well. So I'd give it the thumbs up.
Yeah, I go all the guns on that. It's on my list too. So, yeah, The Beef on Netflix. Dan, it is now time for Movie of the Week.
It is indeed. So each week, Paul and I take turns choosing different movies of the week. If you'd like to find out what that movie is before we talk about it here on the podcast, then you should join our Discord channel where we announce that movie every week. Today, Paul, we are reviewing the 2023 movie Air.
Air. So Air follows the history of shoe salesman Sonny Vaccaro and how he led led Nike in its pursuit of the greatest athlete in the history of basketball, Michael Jordan. I'm going to hand to you first of all, Dan, but this, of course, when I mentioned at the top of the podcast that a microphone is just a microphone until Dan Whiting King talks into it, this is the famous quote, a shoe is just a shoe until my son steps into it, as Mrs. Jordan describes what she thinks is going to happen once Michael Jordan steps into a Nike shoe. What are we thinking, Dan?
So this is a star-studded movie. Like, we've got Matt Damon, we've got Jason Bateman, we've got Ben Affleck. Ben Affleck's not only starring in this, he's also directing. This movie was a lot of fun. For me, probably about 2 years ago, I read the book Shoe Dog, which is basically the Phil Knight kind of story of Nike and how they came to be and his sort of journey, very much from, as it sort of mentioned in the movie, selling shoes at the back of his car and eventually building the huge mega brand that is Nike. I, as you know, Paul, and people that know me, I'm definitely a bit of a sneakerhead. I dabble in the sneakers. Mm-hmm. I had a really great time. I enjoyed kind of the speed and the pace of this movie. It had a few great laughs. I felt like I learned a few things, particularly about sort of Adidas and Converse. And I just loved going back into that that sort of 80s period. And I don't know about you, but I, as a kid, always wanted some Nikes or some Reeboks, and we just never had them. It wasn't in our realm of possibilities. It wasn't until I became an adult and became unchecked that I became obsessed with sneakers. This is a fun, informative, and enjoyable watch. And what was really interesting is Samara loved this movie. She was like, she's been raving about it all week since we've watched it, and that she's how much of a good time she had. She didn't expect to like it. It's not really her genre, but she really got behind it. And I think because it is such a great story, like obviously when it's only sort of 2 hours long, they do have to skip over a lot of the details, but you know, what Michael Jordan's mum did in the sort of the sneaker business was a game changer for the whole contract licensing model for athletes going forward. It's incredible what, you know, it's a bit like the Tetris movie when we watched it, right? Like it's kind of just so fascinating to see how many sales they actually made, what it went on to do for the company, how it took them from kind of being a, not a last by any stretch of the imagination, but it boosted them to the top of the food chain. And I had a fantastic time.
Yeah, I did too. And I've been kind of semi-raving about it as well. And part of that is because, once again, I had no idea what I was getting myself into. I have many times made an assessment based on poster and cast and director. And so I see the poster, I see Matt Damon, Ben Affleck, Jason Bateman, and then you know, Viola Davis. It just goes on, and I'm like, oh yeah, I'm in. And then I see it's directed by Ben Affleck, who I think I rate almost more as a director than an actor. Actually, when you think about the movies like Argo, the Gone Baby Gone, The Town, you know, all top movies, I think. And of course, the two of them coming back together again, there's a lot of excitement about those two, you know, after so many years being on screen together again. Once you sort of get past that excitement, I had no idea that this was a basketball movie or anything. So straight away I was like, you know, I'll admit I'm not someone who watches or follows basketball in any way, shape, or form. When I was at school, Dan, it was actually it was high tech and troop trainers, or sneakers, as you fellas call it. I always call it trainers. I don't call it shoes or sneakers. I always call it trainers. That was the thing. That was the vibe at our school. But it didn't matter. It didn't matter that I wasn't a Nike fan. It didn't matter I wasn't a basketball fan. This movie really got me. And I just, even though I know that behind, you know, this whole drive, the signing of Michael Jordan, it's all about money, obviously, even though it's all about sales and dollar, I cannot help myself being swept away in the moment in the Matt Damon speech and just feeling really moved by all of it. And all of a sudden just, you know, just wanting this team to succeed. And of course, we all knew that it was going to, because we know that there are Air Jordan. So we knew it was going to happen, but it was the journey to get there. Just like Queen Charlotte, we knew she was going to be queen. It's the journey to get there. That was where the joy was.
And I think for me, it's even just, and again, like you know the result of the movie, but it still kind of emotionally draws you in. Like, are they going to seal the deal? Are they going to make it? I love Peter Moore, played by Matthew Mayhew, and just kind of like, you know, having, you know, if you don't come in Saturday, don't bother coming Sunday. Like, you know, you've got a weekend to design like a custom shoe for an athlete. The way they went on to do the silhouette of Jordan, like, just, I just loved all those little touches of detail. And it's the one thing that was sort of interesting in this is, I guess, the way they deliberately didn't show Michael Jordan. Like, you know, obviously they had him in the room, but it felt awkward that he kind of like was always kind of hidden by camera shot. Like, I wonder why they made that choice.
I feel the opposite. And I think my interpretation of why they might have made that choice was, the instant, if we had seen the face of the actor, the instant we see the face and the instant we realize, oh, that's not Michael Jordan, I think there would be something of a disconnect. Because we're expecting him to look like Michael Jordan, and no matter what they do, he won't be. And so I think by just simply having that presence in the room and having the right sort of stature and frame was quite a clever move, because at all times during the movie, I could imagine in my own mind, oh yeah, that's Michael Jordan right there, right now. And it felt real. But if you'd show me his face and it wasn't, I just think that would have lost. And that's me talking as a non-basketball fan as well.
I guess that, like, Michael Jordan does have such a classic and iconic look that you're right. It just kind of felt weird to me that, like, it was almost kind of like, you know, remember in Home Improvement, the TV show, how they're always hiding Wilson's face? It felt like that type of thing to me. Like, what? Like, someone would just, like, walk in front of the camera, or he'd just kind of be, like, skulking around in the background. And there was an awkwardness to it for me for some reason, even though, like, I'm accepting that we didn't need to see him, but just the way it played out felt funny.
Yeah, fair enough. One thing that didn't feel awkward was just the whole vibe of the movie, and the whole, right from the start, from the soundtrack to all the scenes they were showing us in the opening sort of 2-3 minutes as the credits were sort of playing out, of like really acclimatizing us to this 80s moment. It was just the look, the fashion, no cell phones, you know, all the time having to sort of their pages going off and having to run to a payphone. That whole, I love anything that takes me back to the 80s in that respect. It always plays out well.
That is a very good shout. Like, the soundtrack on this is absolutely killer. Like, I just found myself, you know, just kind of like singing along in my seat. Like, it was so on point.
Really on point. And, the casting decisions that were made, and I've for once done a little bit of reading around it, because Michael Jordan wasn't involved at all, but he did have a couple of requests, and the one that stuck out to me was that he requested that Viola Davis play his mother, and I did find her presence in the room very powerful. Like, she's really, like, when she's on the phone to Matt Damon's character and she's talking through what his terms are going to be. And as you said, that's the moment that changed licensing in sportswear forever. That was a really, really powerful scene between two people at the top of their game. Because for me, Matt Damon is probably the standout in this movie. I feel like it's his best movie for him that we've seen for a while.
I think, yeah, I think next time I'm having any type of pay review, I definitely want Viola Davis yes. on the phone for me. And yeah, I think you're right. Like, I thought Matt Damon was great. And I think what I appreciate about, you know, Matt Damon and Ben Affleck coming back together is it always feels natural. Like, it never feels forced to me.
Yeah.
And it's, yeah, I think just so well done. And it's interesting kind of seeing I don't want to body shame him, but, you know, a bigger Matt Damon.
That was quite deliberate. And he, you know, of course, the scene at the end with the running track, I mean, that's just, there's just a lot of fun moments between the two of them, a lot of great dialogue back and forth. And Jason Bateman also, you know, in amongst this, because he's something that I've seen him in a few things lately, where he's been less comedy and more, so I thought he was really effective in his role as well. I just felt that everything worked throughout the movie and it went so quickly. And I don't know about you, Dan, but again, I know I've been really, well, I didn't with the Streetcar Named Desire, but everything else, I've been coming in all the guns on this week.
Yeah, this is all the guns for me as well. And I think this is probably one of the most fun movies of the week. I feel like I've watched it in a while. Like, it just sort of like, it was a, like, I genuinely just had sort of like a smile on my face and had a good time, like, for most of the movie. It was a good time.
Yeah. I think it's two good weeks in a row, because Bullet Train was also a massive hit as well. So that is Air. And where are we watching that, Dan?
We are watching Air on Prime Video.
Correct. What's your pick of the week?
What is my pick of the week? I think it's going to have to be Air. I think, actually, is it going to be Beef? It's tough because Beef was kind of the week before for me, but no, it's going to be Air. Air is going to be the pick of the week for me.
Nice. Well, I'll make it easy for you, because Beef for me has to be my pick of the week, because that's a show that I nearly didn't watch, and it's a lesson to me to not judge a book by its cover or make assumptions. That series is way more than the synopsis makes you think it is. So that's my pick of the week. And with that, we're due for some news, Dan.
All right. So not too much on the news yesterday, but we've got a couple of things. So first of all, you know, we've been talking about Netflix cracking down on password sharing. They have released an addition to the Netflix plan where, and it's, they're just trialing this at the moment by the looks of it. So in Canada, New Zealand, Portugal, and Spain, you can now create, or you can add on a feature called password sharing, and you pay an extra $7.99 here, and you can give your account and password to another family not living in your primary location.
Wow, that's not a bad deal at all, actually, when you think about the money. If you've got like the premium one with the multiple screens and so on, it's not bad at all.
And that's $7.99 New Zealand. So actually, like, if you were sharing it with a family, like, probably a good way to cut down on the cost of Netflix.
100%.
Yeah, so interesting model. They're also starting to sort of ramp up their password sharing crackdown in the States at the moment. So it'll be interesting to see how this sort of rolls out. I think this feels like kind of quite a good compromise. Be interesting to see what happens in the near future. Speaking of Netflix, they have also, I don't know if you've seen this news, Paul, they have just hired a chief action officer.
Action. What a great title.
Such a great title. Guess who's playing that role? Arnold Schwarzenegger himself.
That's so cool. I was just going to say, have they got Rocky or have they got Arnie? They have actually got, that's incredible.
So on a little short that Netflix has released, like, Arnold Schwarzenegger rolls up in a tank, and that's genuinely his new title, the Chief Action Officer. Like, how great is that? What a role.
I've seen the scene with him rolling up in the tank, but that's a trailer from his new series, FUBAR, which I'm going to watch that. I don't know if you're keen on a joint review for that. We haven't talked about that, but I've seen the trailer with the tank, and it's for the new series.
Oh, is it? I thought it was. Oh, I've seen a few things about it. What is FUBAR going to be, a TV show or a movie?
FUBAR drops tomorrow, and it's a TV series. It's Schwarzenegger's first TV series.
Wow. Interesting. Maybe that's all part of it. What else have I got here? So this is an interesting bit of news on the Star Wars front. So Natalie Portman has revealed in an interview that she would be up for returning to Star Wars as Padme Amidala. So obviously this would be very timeline specific because, spoilers, Padme does meet her demise. But interesting that I think someone like Natalie Portman would think about coming back to the Star Wars universe.
Yeah, it's not someone who I'd have expected to return, but at the same token, we've seen Hayden Christensen return recently, so I guess depending on what they're planning on doing, there could be a possibility. But yes, it would be a very specific window of time.
Got to get the gang back together. What else have we got here? So Futurama, season 11. So this has been a long time in the making. That is coming out on the 24th of July, and they're going to be released weekly. So fans of Futurama, it's been a 10-year wait, but you are getting another season.
Oh.
What else have we got here? Netflix have been working on a Squid Game reality TV show, and that is going to be arriving in November this year. A lot of interesting and sort of mixed press around the conditions on that TV show. And apparently some of the contestants have had to be in some pretty unsafe and unsanitary environment. But we'll see what happens there. And then final bit of news for me. It's a bit of a sad one. The unfortunate passing of actor Ray Stevenson. So a very young 58 years old. We were about to see him in the Ahsoka Star Wars TV show. He's been in so many great movies and TV shows. Maybe we need a peak performance for him, actually. He's been in a lot. So very sad and untimely passing.
Yeah, no, definitely. So it'd be nice, of course, if we'll have the chance to see him, as you say, in Ahsoka at least. But so young at 58. Just awful.
Indeed. Any news at your end, Paul?
Well, I was just looking at while you were talking there, Dan. Yeah, Schwarzenegger's series FUBAR drops 25 May. So by the time this podcast comes out, it will have just dropped. And yeah, it's a TV action adventure thriller TV series about a CIA operative on the edge of retirement, discovers a family secret and is called back into the field for one last job.
I bet you it's going to be 10 episodes, is it? Let me just. Oh, that's eight episodes. Okay, eight episodes. All right.
It wasn't going to be 7 or 9, was it? No, but
no.
Look, from the trailer, there's a definite comedy element to it, and I'm quite comfortable with that because that's probably how it's going to work best. I'll be going along for the ride on that one at some point.
Sounds good.
But beyond that, then. No, I haven't got. It was definitely, as you say, a very, very quiet week in terms of news. So no news for me this week, Dan.
How about the mailbag?
Mailbag, we have a couple of things. So firstly, Leandre Thomas, director of Star Wars Vision, the episode The Pit, which you yourself, Dan, gave a special mention last week. He shared our post about Star Wars Visions on Instagram, which is always cool and also very rare, I find, for anyone connected with the Star Wars universe to ever engage on social media, to be honest. So that was quite
100%.
Nice.
100%. Yeah, that's so rare, isn't it?
Yeah, yes. It always makes you think there must be something in their contracts to not do it. But Leandre, thank you very much for that. The T-1000 himself, Robert Patrick, he liked our post for take one of Kind Eyes. Not the first time he's engaged with us, actually, Dan. So I feel that means we can now call him a friend of the show. Is it a show? I don't think this is a show. If it is, this isn't what I thought show business would be like.
I think it's a show.
It's a show? Okay. Mm. Well, speaking of show business, see, now this is actually a smooth segue now. There's hope for us. The official Damian Lewis fan club shared our link to last week's podcast on their Facebook page, and they've got like 67,000 followers. So that was kind of a nice treat. That was our peak performance post for Damian Lewis. And the fan club themselves actually went with Homeland and revealed that it was Brody's character that inspired them to start this whole thing up. So that was a big endorsement for Homeland. Other suggestions coming through. This is a real tight race this week. Norman from Roddenberry.com, he said he would always applaud Damien's portrayal as Dick Winters, but Brody in Homeland was the most riveting performance. Kajar from Serbia replied on Twitter with Band of Brothers, Diana from Capri Coast, Homeland, Mr. Chalmers from the fine state of North Carolina, Band of Brothers, runner-up Homeland, and Paddy from Time Traveling Tink Podcast. 3-2-1 was Dreamcatcher, then Homeland, and his peak performance was Band of Brothers. So a lot of people, just like us last week in Tune, two standout roles for Damian Lewis that really most people are going with, which is not often the case. Often there's a variety of stuff, but most people are going Homeland or Band of Brothers. That's our mailbag then.
Very good. Shall we jump into our peak performance for this week?
Indeed. So like our move of the week, Dan and I take it in turns every week to look back at the careers of someone from the Hollywood industry and try and pick out what we think is their best work. On the subject of Streetcar Named Desire, it was that conversation that drove us to go for Marlon Brando this week. And I'm really keen to hear what you have done. So I'm going to pass the Rako to you first of all.
All right. So I guess quite an older back catalogue, but there's two standouts for me. I know there's many more than that, but I'm going to go for an honourable mention of 1978 Superman and Marlon Brando's role as Superman's father, Jor-El. Like, just such a classic role. And to be honest, probably my first time really coming across Marlon Brando as an actor.
Same.
For my peak performance, I've got to go for the obvious one. I've got to go for 1972's The Godfather, a movie that has been, like, it's a pinnacle of any movie buff, anyone who appreciates sort of quality cinema. This is a movie that's kind of stood the test of time. It's a fantastic series. It's so classic Marlon Brando. Like, I feel like I couldn't think of a more signature role for a character. And so Marlon Brando is Don Vito Corleone. So The Godfather, 1972. Nice. We're in the 70s. Classics. How about you, Paul?
I love that. I had a number of contenders for honourable mention, and in the end I actually settled on a way more recent movie. This is 2001. The Score, opposite Edward Norton, Robert De Niro, and Andrew Bassett. And I think for me, other than the excitement of seeing Brando and De Niro on screen together for the first and only time, I think what I liked about this movie and this performance, in particular his performance, because I've actually given Edward Norton a peak performance of The Score as well, but his performance in this movie from Brando was, so much was improvised, completely improvised. And it's a combination of Brando at his absolute worst and his best. The worst being the fact that he refused to work with Frank Oz, the director, throughout the movie, and was really disrespectful towards him. And De Niro had to come in and direct the scenes that Brando was in from halfway through the movie onwards, because he just refused to come back. But then when he was doing those scenes, he was improvising, and not just some of the dialogue, but like complete new directions of scenes, which as a writer, I'm sure they were like, what's going on here? But also probably thinking, hey, we've got a scene here with De Niro and Brando. But like, there's a scene where, and I've watched all the behind scenes videos of this movie, which is why I'm kind of quite familiar with it. But when De Niro asks Brando's character for $1 million, Brando improvises, picking up a telephone. He starts talking, going, oh, operator, I've got a nutcase here asking for $1 million, and what should I do? And he just does it so effortlessly. And De Niro's reactions to it then also has to be improvised. So this is 2001. So this is 50 years after A Streetcar Named Desire, which I talked about earlier. And I really, really love this movie for a number of reasons and a number of performances. So that is the one which won out for me for honourable mention. But yeah, the peak, I just, as you would say, Dan, I cannot go past his performance as Don Vito Corleone. It's just iconic. It's an impeccable, he just, that whole look, even before you think about the film or the performance, just the way he looked. He did something with his mouth, and it was his idea. When he came in and auditioned, he decided he wanted Don Corleone to look like a like a bulldog, he said. So he stuffed his cheeks with cotton wool for the audition, and then he wore a mouthpiece. It's so good. And this is him in his prime, and he came on the screen and was able to, intimidate Pacino's Michael Corleone and so many great one lines. The look, the eyebrows, the gestures, and then he has those scenes towards the end with his grandchild and how all that melts away and he has fun. It's truly one of the all-time greatest movies and a stellar performance. So yeah, I really like the fact there that you called out Superman, because that was my first encounter with it. And I always remember how Brando's name was first in the credits and I was like, who is this guy? Why isn't it Christopher Reeve? I didn't understand it. And I got lost in a bit of a wormhole of reading about Brando, and Christopher Reeve criticized him, saying that he was lazy. And one of the things that Brando did when he came on set was he said to the director, Richard Donner, he said, as we're doing the rehearsals, maybe we should record them because you never know, we might get a good take. And of course they did record them. And then Brando basically said, that's good enough. And was just like, that way he always had these tricks that he'd pull so that he could get out of having to do more and more takes. And I just don't think there's many people in the world that could get away with it. But Brando just seemed to have this power to be able to do that back in the day. He just commanded it so much. And it's terrible, really, but that's who he was.
It's funny, I don't quite remember the story, but remember when we watched the Val Kilmer documentary?
Yes.
And Val Kilmer had a similar story about Marlon Brando on...
Island of Dr. Moreau.
Yeah. And so, God, it must just be such a nightmare just dealing with these, like, the unbearable weight of massive talent, So.
Yeah. I'd love to know the stories from Don Juan DeMarco, which was a Brando 90s movie with him and Johnny Depp, because Johnny Depp is a character as well. And I can only imagine what on earth it would have been like on set with those two.
Those are good shouts, Paul. And I love the extra trivia as well.
Yeah, he's an actor that's just fascinated me for years. And the more I learn about him, actually, the less I seem to really like him. But when I see him on screen, like I did with Streetcar, it's something about him that is quite captivating.
And look, The Godfather, 1.9 million people, and it's still got a rating of 9.2. Incredible.
What can you say?
Well, I guess that brings us to the end of another episode of the Half Measures podcast.
It does indeed. Let us know your peak performance of Marlon Brando. Do get in touch with us. Thank you for listening in once again, and check out more of our links on our website, halfmeasurespodcast.com.
Also, a very special shout out to our Patreon producers, Samara Whiting-King, Diana Kanawa, Trisha Brady, and Michael Chalmers. If you too would like to become a patron of the Half Measures podcast, then you can find those details in the show notes below. But until next week, everyone, adios.